I'm Carson Sestouli of Fangraphs.com, and this is the Pitch Talks Blue Jays podcast, brought to you by Homestand Sports. It is the Pitch Talks Blue Jays podcast. That is a fact. I'm Carson Sestouli, one of the hosts of this program. Joining me as a guest co-host today on the program is lead prospect analyst emeritus, formerly the lead prospect analyst for Fangraphs.com, currently a member of Team Fangraphs, but not currently the lead prospect analyst. It's Kylie McDaniel. Kylie, hello.
Hello. Don't say bonjour, though, because this is not a French-Canadian podcast.
No, it's not a French-Canadian podcast, but it's for anyone who wants to listen. It is very democratic in that way. You are here for a couple reasons. You're here. One reason you're here is because Dave Cameron is not here. The erstwhile managing editor of Fangraphs.com is no longer part of Fangraphs.com at all. In fact, he is helping the San Diego Padres build out the research and development department. So that is one reason why you're here. The other reason you're here is because, as noted, you have some expertise in the field of prospect analysis. And I think that after covering last week, the Jays offseason, it makes sense to cast a glance at the Jays of the future, which is in part what we will do today. Does that characterize that correctly?
Yeah, I would say that is generally my expertise, and okay. I will try to not betray your evaluation of my ability.
All right, very good. Before we get to that cracking hot analysis, Kylie, it is both my privilege and my obligation to announce that Homestand Sports is our patron, and Homestand Sports is also noteworthy for because they facilitate the Pitch Talks events. And then, in fact, there is a Pitch Talks event coming up. It is an event known as the Mark Shapiro Town Hall. It will feature most notably Blue Jays president Mark Shapiro. It will also feature second most notably Ashley Docking, and third most notably I will be working as a host in some capacity for this event, an event which takes place at the Royal Theater at 608 College Street in Toronto. That's April 5th, 7 to 10 p.m., Royal Theater. For tickets, go to homestandsports.com. That's homestandsports.com. Do not, Kylie, as I found out last year, do not go to homelandsports.com because one year arrives at a very patriotic sporting website. So nothing to be seen there. But that is Homestand Sports and Pitch Talks events. I don't think you've been to a Pitch Talks event, but maybe I'm wrong.
I have not.
Okay.
True, I have not been.
Okay, a lively event is what I've been led to believe, and I will see it with my own eyes April 5th at the Royal Theater on College Street.
Are you implying patriotic websites are not good?
I'm not saying that, but for those who are looking for cracking hot analysis regarding the Toronto Blue Jays, it will be a non-starter.
You'll likely find no Blue Jays content there.
Someone who might be a starter for the Toronto Blue Jays, so, and this is a segue that you're witnessing, is, any of the players we mentioned today might be. But you and Eric Longenhagen, at some point over the last month, you composed and published your top 100 prospect list for Fangraphs.com. Five Blue Jays on that, and I think it probably makes the most sense to look after them now, to look over them here. Now, what I want to say, and perhaps I should phrase this in the form of a question. There are a number of prospect lists out there. What do you view when you've done it now, you've done it a couple times for Fangraphs, what do you view as sort of what is at the root of the Fangraphs methodology? What might do you think separate it from the sort of lists that are found elsewhere?
It's something that Eric and I kind of focused on for this year. I guess especially with me coming from a front office
I should mention that you until recently you were working in front office of the Atlanta Braves.
Yeah, not to be a job dropper. It just seemed to fit into the conversation.
No, that's fine. That's one of your credentials. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So I had found that there was a gap between the public meaning sort of all the lists for all of time, including the last one I did on my own, where there was a focus on sort of upside and in a lot of cases unlikely scenarios at the expense of likely scenarios of, you know, this this guy projects to be an average everyday player. He's in AAA. We've been writing about him for 6 years. Not very exciting. Nobody's going to do a backflip when he comes up and puts up two WAR. But putting up two WAR for three straight years at the league minimum is very valuable. And how many of these, you know, tools goofs in low A are actually going to put up six WAR in their entire career, much less starting next year as a big league starter, and not be, you know, subjected to waivers in the Rule 5 draft and, you know, injuries and risk and all these various other things. So I wanted to move us a little more in that direction, which Eric had already sort of been thinking about on his own. So it wasn't that hard to do. So I think our list focuses a little more on balancing those things, I think, correctly, which it turns out in comparison to other lists will give you a more average everyday player that is big league ready, will be a little higher. The sort of tools goof, think like the power hitting guy in rookie ball or the high school player that was just drafted high that has a lot of tools but maybe can't pick pitches very well, or the pitcher that can throw 100 but hasn't really developed a slider or changeup or command yet but everything looks like he could, that guy's gonna be a little bit lower. So I guess that would sort of, our focus would sort of lean in that direction.
Right. And then even for, I feel like even for, you know, prospects who are considered top prospects, like we're going to be discussing certainly Vlad Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette, both at the top 10 of your top 100 prospects list. It does seem to me to be an emphasis on understanding precisely, not just essentially delineating that each of those players' talent relative to all the other prospects, you know, scattered across the minor leagues at this point, but also attempting to really understand what it means in terms of wins.
Yeah, and I guess one other thing that I left out of what we said before was that the valuing of pitchers historically on these lists has been empirically way out of whack, that they both should not be ranked as high in sort of the top 10 or top 20 overall, and shouldn't be as many of them, like 50-50, I think traditionally is how a lot of these lists have done it in the past, again, including me in the past. And so I think we ended up closer to like 60-40, 65-35 hitters, and we only had we had a pitcher at number one, but it's Ohtani, who's a pitcher and a hitter. We had another pitcher at 8, and then pitchers at 15 and 16, which is unusual how these lists usually play out, where the top 14 had essentially one true pitcher in it, two, if you count Ohtani. And part of that is because of, as you're saying, with the wins, the empirical research of the average, you know, top 30 overall pitcher gives you this many wins. The average top 30 overall hitter gives you significantly more wins, both as far as overall successes and then the wins they give you. And so when you sort of are looking at things as, hey, Colin Moran is going to be a two-win player maybe next year, but almost definitely the year after, when you're comparing to a guy in A-ball that's had one good season, seems silly to have them right next to each other unless the guy in A-ball, you know, has a reasonable upside of being the best player in baseball. For pitchers, looking at the outcomes, it's, we don't know which pitcher's going to fail, but way more of them are failing than is implicit in the way we're ranking them. So let's just move them all down a little bit and try to better recognize like the likely outcomes of the players.
Right, and represent the reality of the situation. I have to think that now, of course, I dabble sometimes in prospect work for Fangraphs, but this is something that's sort of been at the center of your attention for a while now. I have to think that attempting to put grades on pitchers, and in particular, like going back over the first list you did, even if at the time they seemed to reflect industry, they totally reflective of industry consensus, like that has to be a little bit terrifying / humbling, because a lot of pitchers just fall victim to attrition by way of injury or ineffectiveness.
Well, and the, I guess, third-ranked pitcher that we had on the list, Brent Honeywell, in the time between ranking him and now has already blown out his arm, which is exactly the reason that we ranked him 15th and not, you know, 8th, which maybe you could have talked us into if we didn't know that empirical research. And it is kind of random. The number 16 guy, Alex Reyes, would be higher if he didn't have Tommy John the year before. And Shohei Ohtani, the number one guy, has like some elbow questions about what all is going on in there. So of the top four pitchers, two have had surgery. Ohtani probably will at some point in his career. And then number two, Forrest Whitley, just got suspended for PEDs. Now that isn't related to him being a pitcher, but something happened to all four of those guys in the last year, which kind of gives you an example.
All right. So I want to ask you, maybe in a little bit, I want to ask you about some of the guys that might have appeared in your list or who you and Eric maybe esteemed a little bit more highly based off of this this sort of translation of skills to on-field production. But I think it makes sense to start by examining those prospects that are sort of like there's obviously a certain probability they could fail. But Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette, both from the top 10 of your list. let's start with Vlad Guerrero Jr. I'm positive that listeners will be familiar. They'll certainly be familiar with the name because his father had it, and his father's Hall of Famer.
But if somebody's listening to this podcast and doesn't know who Vladimir Guerrero is, I would love to know what led to this point in their
that's
life.
That's a very interesting decision. Yeah, no, that's a good point. Now, you list on the top 100 list of Fangraphs, you list positions. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is, what is he, entering his age 18 season? Does that sound right?
I believe that is correct.
He is listed on, he's listed here.
Sorry, he's 18 right now. He'll be 19 this season.
Okay, he's listed here as an 18-year-old. He's listed here as a first baseman, and yet he's played predominantly third base as a professional. So I think that'd be a good place to start. I'm assuming these are defensive projections as opposed to snapshots of the present.
Yeah, there's a handful of players, I think three or four, that we have projected positions that they essentially don't play or barely play because they sort of project to play there eventually. And there's a couple guys like, you know, Austin Riley, where it's like he's projected at third base. He might be a third baseman, but if he's not...
That's an Atlanta Braves prospect, is that right?
Another top 100 guy that is, you know, projects to be fringy at third base, whereas Vladimir Guerrero Jr. projects to be below average at third base. And if you then look through the big leagues and say how many guys are playing third base on an everyday basis that are below average defenders, there's not a lot of them. Like, teams used to put up with that a little bit, and, you know, like the Tigers played Miguel Cabrera at third base a couple years ago, who was, I don't know, maybe comparable to what Vladimir Guerrero Jr. will be in the big leagues defensively. So obviously there is some precedent to do it, but that's the only example I can think of a guy that was, you know, clearly below average to, you know, casual fans, scouts, metrics, eyeballs, you know, all these sorts of things. And, I mean, I saw Vladimir Guerrero Jr. when he was 14, briefly at a showcase, and then again when he was 15. And he looks like latter career version of his dad physically. Now he's, you know, deceptively quick. He's got pretty good hands. He's got an above average arm, not quite the arm strength his dad has. So there's a reason he's playing third base right now is, you know, maybe you put him, you know, square peg in a round hole, he'll turn into a round peg. Like, you know, maybe it'll happen. If you put him there and he realizes I need to get a little quicker to play here, maybe he'll get a little quicker. Whereas if you put him at first base, like he's going to have no impetus to get quicker. So that could be, and it could work out that that's what happens, and he ends up getting a little quicker and better, and he can play third base, and he's fringy, and he ends up being like Austin Riley, and they're both fine and play there for a while. But it seems likely that his role for the majority, if not the first, you know, couple years of his big league career, will be playing first base because he's not quick enough to play corner outfield, and there's enough defensive ability; he's not a DH. So it would seem to be between third and first, and I would pick first if you made me pick one.
So. Obviously, the case with first base requires a lot of offensive production because of the positional adjustment. I mean, at least in terms of how we calculate wins above replacement at Fangraphs, the positional adjustment is large. It's a large negative adjustment for first base, more so than the corner outfield, and certainly more so than third base. Looking over your list, the one that you composed with Eric, I think that the next first baseman after Vlad Guerrero is Brendan McKay. That's a huge asterisk there because he is also a pitcher. He's in the Tampa Bay Rays system, came out of Louisville.
Which, if he wasn't a pitcher, he'd be lower.
Right. And then I think the next one, again, I could be mistaken, I think is Ryan McCann, a prospect in the Rocky system, who's 83rd. So you have Vlad Guerrero and then a gulf, and then, you know, then you don't have another first baseman to 83rd, which leads me to believe that your estimation of the bat is that it's hugely special.
Yes, we have him projected as a 65 hitter, which would be, you know, 290, maybe a 360, 370 on base with 70 power, which would be 30 home runs. So that would be, you know, something like a 850 to 900 OPS as an expectation. Obviously, there's a chance it's even higher, chance it's even lower, and an average fielder with a plus arm at first base. The interesting thing, we actually, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the 2080 scale, projecting a teenager to be a 65 hitter with 70 power, Like, how many hitters in the big – like, we're expecting him to be that. So it's like a median projection.
Right. And it should be noted, that is the median projection. Right.
Yeah. And so if you're then looking at the big leagues, who is a present 65 hitter with 70 power? Like, what sort of player are we projecting him to be like? There's, like, very few of those players. There's, like, 10 or 15 of them. It's a very small population. And in the chat after the top 100, we had multiple questions asking us why we didn't have 80s on his power or his hit.
Uh-huh.
Like, hey, you think he's going to be one of the top 15 hitters in the big leagues. Why do you hate him? That was essentially the question. And my answer to that was, because some people were saying, like, oh, well, he's, like, you know, some of the rarest performance as far as strikeout to walk rate, you know, batting average power, those sorts of things for his age. The issue that I don't think anyone's really paying attention to, he's hitting for power because he hits the ball really hard, which is obviously very good. He does not lift the ball very much, which I think because he hits the ball very hard, like this is what Ronald Acuna did at this age. He hit the ball really hard, didn't lift it a lot. And then through some combination of people telling him this or him figuring it out on his own, he was like, oh, the ball is like a rocket coming off my bat. I should probably put it in the air more instead of hitting it right at the third baseman, maybe decapitating him and limiting myself to one or two bases and maybe getting it out. If I hit it in the air, maybe no one will catch it. So I think he will do that because he's been hitting it more in the air than he was the year before that. And now that he's sort of, you know, conquered full season ball, he can sort of move on to making adjustments as opposed to not trying to survive. But, you know, I don't think he knew exactly how season would go. He's like, let me just keep doing what I'm doing. Now it's let's make some adjustments and get myself ready for the big leagues. So I will imagine that he will then start lifting the ball more. And obviously, if you make your swing path more uphill, that will lead to more swings and misses, and presumably more of a sort of power-based approach, which maybe let more balls go by, maybe even more walks. So then you look at his sort of historic performance and say, oh, well, the strikeout rate is going to go up probably. The batting average will probably go down a little bit. The power will go up, and the walks will probably also go up. It's probably a net neutral to positive. But looking at scouting the stat line, as it were, and saying, oh, why is this guy an 80 hitter? It's like, well, then wire me and Eric here. Like, if you want to do that, then be my guest. But you have to sort of, we're here to tell you things like that. Like, he's not lifting the ball as much as guys like this normally do. And I think he is exactly the kind of guy and exactly the kind of organization where they're going to teach him to do that. And almost every guy that I know that have this sort of feel for hitting and this sort of exit velo and have performed like this, they can all make this adjustment if they want to.
Hey, let me ask you, you mentioned the possibility of Guerrero lifting the ball in the future. How comfortable, how safe do you think it is, or how comfortable do you feel projecting it, or how safe do you think it is to project mechanical changes for players who, in the case of, you know, Vlad Guerrero, who are entering their age 19 season? And let me preface this by saying this, is that there has been some discussion this offseason, certainly in the electronic pages of Fangraphs, about Eric Hosmer, right, who kind of has almost the precise sort of profile you were just discussing. Like, he hits the ball very hard. I think he's among the best ball strikers in among major league hitters, and yet he also puts the ball on the ground much more frequently than average relative to other hitters. And so the idea is, like, well, maybe he is worth a larger contract because he could, he could execute some sort of mechanical adjustment. However, he's like a 28-year-old person, and he's had success. He's been compensated for success, so his incentives to change are limited, and that is even if he could figure out how to do it. I assume with someone like Vladimir Guerrero, you can project a mechanical change much more easily, but what do you think? I mean, I'm not asking you to put exact numbers on it, but how do you sort of perform those sort of rough calculations in your head?
Well, I think one of the I don't have any data to back this up, but if you look at the guys that have successfully, especially in the big leagues, made swing changes, especially the little guys that you don't think have the raw power to do certain things, and then, you know, guys like Altuve or Mookie
Jose
Betts.
Ramirez.
Yeah, these sorts of guys are now lifting the ball, Francisco Lindor, and hitting home runs. Typically, they are plus bat control, good feel for the strike zone, like generally sort of savvy hitters. that have performed in their career, and you're basically telling them, like, hey, we're going to make the strike zone 6 inches bigger on all sides, they could probably figure that out more quickly than the average hitter would. And so if you tell them, hey, you need to put the ball in the air a little more, you know, it turns out the baseballs are different or the bats are different or whatever's going on, they can probably do that too. So I don't know if it's, you know, hand speed or bat control or bat speed or athleticism overall or hitting, you know, knowledge, or, you know, it could be any number of these things. It's probably a combination of them, not any one of them. Something like that, I think, allows you to make that adjustment. Not to say that Eric Hosmer doesn't have these things, but he also, like you were saying, got paid tens of millions of dollars doing what he was doing before and wasn't in the most progressive organization that's going to tell him he should do this. I mean, there's a reason Mike Moustakas had the same problem. Whereas other teams, multiple players made this adjustment that were similar hitters. So I think given the Toronto organization, you know, being on the progressive side, Vlad Jr. being a younger hitter with very good feel, and Vlad Jr. now motivated to say, I'm sure, I want to go to the big leagues, I want to go to the big leagues now, and Toronto can say, okay, if you can do this, then you can go to the big leagues. And if he goes and hits 30 home runs next year, like, they have a little leverage over him to say, like, do what you want, but if you do this, you're going to get there faster. Trust me. And then he can probably do it. Whereas when he's in the big leagues getting paid and getting paid well and being told he's, like, the team leader in the face of the franchise, and he was 25, like Eric Hosmer, then probably a little less likely, even if he physically could do it.
Okay. That's quite a bit about Vlad Guerrero. It's also about other things like swing changes, et cetera. I think it makes sense to discuss your other top 10 prospect who's also a member of the Toronto Blue Jays, and that is Bo Bichette. I will say, interesting about Bo Bichette, last year when Eric Longenhagen did his list of the top prospects in the Jays system, Bichette was ranked 10th in the system, and now he's ranked 9th in out of all rookie-eligible players. Something substantial happened. What was that something?
Bichette is in, not Eric, is an interesting...
Eric's interesting too, it should be noted, but not for
not,
baseball skill.
Not for the same reasons as Bo Bichette. He was a very interesting test case that I think will now be used in draft rooms as, like, somebody will say, hey, what about this guy? And someone will be like, I don't know. And they go, what about Bo Bichette? Like, I think that's going to become a shorthand for a lot of things now. So he has a very idiosyncratic swing where he swings as hard as he can. It is a sort of moving parts, some would say long in the sense that his hands and feet are doing a lot of things, not long in the sense of a long path to the ball, which is an important distinction. He has plus bat speed, probably 65, maybe 70 raw power. He also can play the infield. He also had a dad that played in the big leagues and a little brother who was drafted in the first round and completely flamed out with a kind of similar swing. So, and this is also all happened the year before the airball revolution in the big leagues. So it was not only seen as, yeah, he's got some bloodlines, yeah, he's got some tools, but nobody can swing like that in the big leagues. And then after he was drafted, like 6 months later, a bunch of dudes started swinging like that in the big leagues and started getting a lot better. And then at the same time, Bo Bichette finally got enough of an opportunity in full season ball to perform. And then he started performing. And now it's like, if you wondered what when the sort of, you know, swing changes, airball revolution, whatever you want to call it, and the big league would filter down to the draft and, like, amateur coaching of players for the draft, it's when somebody's going to look bad. And now a bunch of teams look bad over Bo Bichette because they all knew exactly how many tools he had and exactly how good he was, saw him for multiple years. Like, me and Eric probably saw him a combined 10 times before the draft. And he went in the second round, and a year later is the 10th best prospect in baseball. All of those scouting directors, all 29 of them, had a chance at him and did not take him, and they look stupid now. And so now he is the example, and much the same way that Jeff Luhnow now getting a GM job became the reason why every team now does analytics in the draft room, because all of those scouting directors got passed by. Now Bo Bichette is the reason that every team, some of them already were going to, but now every team will give these guys a fair chance when they weren't before.
And what is the, we talked about it at some length with regard to Vlad Guerrero, what is the what is the defensive prognosis for Bo Bichette, and I guess how much does it matter?
It doesn't really matter that much. He's playing shortstop now. I don't think anybody thinks he's going to be an average shortstop in the big leagues. The foot speed is just okay. It's, you know, around average. It'll probably be a little below average by the time he, you know, becomes what he's going to become. The arms above, he could play third base pretty easily. The question is, can he play second, which has, you know, obviously a little more defensive value. We project him to second because we sort of think that's probably his best combination of where he can fit defensively and probably be average. And also his, well, we project him to be a 50 hitter with 60 game power, but 70 raw power. So, you know, a conservative projection. Where that sort of above average offensive profile at third base, it's, you know, pretty good. And then at second base, it's a lot better. So we think that's will be where he lands. But the question of, is he going to be below average at shortstop or fringy at second or average at third? Like, it's not an enormous difference. He's going to play in the infield. And it seems like these days a lot of teams have infielders like, you know, Alex Bregman and Marwin Gonzalez and Javi Baez and Ian Happ on the Cubs and Astros, where they can all play multiple positions. And like, even the Cubs have a good third baseman and Chris Bryant, they play him in the outfield sometimes. So it seems like the exact definition of what position you play isn't super important, other than the shortstop and the first baseman probably. And then everyone else can kind of play everywhere. And I think he fits in that. Yeah, he can play a bunch of places and probably isn't a shortstop.
I think that's a good point too, because, and this happens especially in prospect analysis, looking at guys who are regarded as fringy center fielders, right? And that frequently is sort of a scarlet letter of sorts. But a lot of times those guys are also above average corner outfielders. And so they're not actually worth any less than a fringy center fielder. A fringy center fielder is the same thing as an above average corner outfielder, I guess is my point. An average or better second baseman is the same thing as a below average shortstop, right? So it's just a question of value. And if the club feels like it's, what, better situated playing Bichette at second or third and having maybe a slightly more defensive-oriented shortstop, then it seems like that's the path they can go. But it doesn't really affect Bichette's value at the major league level.
No, I think in a similar way, like with Miguel Cabrera being a, I don't know, fringy first baseman and then a well below average third baseman, except in extreme circumstances, I think the difference in defensive value of the position gets canceled out by the difference in defensive performance at the position.
Now, we should definitely talk about this. We've mentioned Vlad Guerrero, who's the son of a very good baseball player. We've mentioned Bo Bichette, who's the son of a capable ball player. Dante Bichette obviously had some huge offensive seasons in the early days of Coors Field. After adjusting for park factor, does look a little bit more pedestrian. But he still certainly had a career. The Blue Jays also have two kind of other interesting prospects with pretty significant bloodlines, I think. Infielder Kevin Biggio? Second baseman, and then also Roger Clemens. And is it Casey Clemens?
Yep, first baseman. So it's three Hall of Famers, and Dante Bichette is like the disappointing athlete of those four.
That's the most
disappointing. Who made tens of millions of dollars.
but Biggio, this version of Biggio and Clemens, they actually have some substance prospects, don't they?
Yeah. Kevin Biggio is another guy he was a guy out of high school, obviously coming from a well-off financial family. He decided to go to school at Notre Dame. Didn't quite meet expectations there performance-wise, but the tools were still there. So he went, I believe, in the fourth round, a little later. Probably slipped a little later than he should. I know a couple teams told me that, he was second or third in our list in the second or third round. And, you know, he just kind of kept not being the top guy on the board when it came around. And he's hit well in pro ball. It looks like there could be average game power in addition to his probably solid average raw power. He can be average, maybe a little above at second base. You can see a 50-55 bat. Obviously, he's not blowing your hair back. Probably not a Hall of Famer, if I had to guess. But if you could see a 100 WRC plus, an average contributor offensively, and a guy that can play an average to a little above second base, that's, you know, a really good player. And it might end up being less than that. Maybe he, you know, falls off or continues not performing in the ways that he, you know, disappointed a little bit at Notre Dame. But he also may be one of those guys that's just a little more suited to holding the wood bat with professional coaching and, you know, all that kind of stuff, which would not be the first guy that happened to.
Now, you mentioned Notre Dame. What do they play their baseball in? What conference is that? Is that Big Ten or ACC or what?
I believe the ACC.
Okay. There's not a lot. I feel like, Jeff Samardzija came out of Notre Dame. But besides him, he was there mostly for football. Besides him, they don't seem to produce a lot of talent.
Their next best baseball player is Pat Connaughton, who's currently in the NBA. It's not a great sign.
I don't even know if that's damning. I don't know. It's damning not with faint praise.
Yeah, they had an NBA player on the mound. That's, like, impressive in one way, but the fact that they couldn't find better baseball players, maybe.
Yeah, that's right. That seems peculiar to me. It seems peculiar in general, but I guess the whole situation is peculiar, as you note, because he did come from a family with money, which gives him some options as an amateur, I suppose.
Yeah, and there's Biggio struck out a good bit as a 22-year-old in high A last year as part of a little more of a late count power approach. So he could eventually end up being that, you know, the guy that hits 240 with 15 homers. It's just sort of a good bench bat. That would sort of be the less good outcome. But, you know, all that to say, he doesn't seem to be getting a lot of attention. He went in the fifth round, turns out, in the draft. So that's why a bunch of teams had him in the third or fourth round. And so he ended up just slipping to the fifth for whatever reason. So, yeah, he's perfectly fine. And I don't think people think he's perfectly fine. I think some people see his name. They're like, oh, I don't hear much about him. He's probably just sailing by in his dad's name. It's like, no, this guy's actually pretty good.
And then, yeah, so on this particular matrix, floating by versus actually good, where does Casey Clemens appear there?
So he signed as a senior out of Texas last year. So he's already 23 and hasn't played in full season ball yet. So, and he's a first baseman. So we're obviously a little further down, obviously, the defensive spectrum and then also the prospect spectrum, since he obviously didn't sign as a junior. But again, coming from a more well-off family, you'd rather finish your education, get your degree, than get a little extra money. In some cases, that would be the case. But he hits the ball hard. It's plus raw power. He had surprisingly low strikeout rates for a sort of power-based, later count kind of guy in college, especially in his senior year. He seemed to make a big adjustment and got over some nagging injuries. He performed well in short season for the Blue Jays, 14% walks, 19% strikeouts, and a 129 WRC+. So was sort of above average at everything while being a little old for the level. He's another guy that, you know, probably ends up being more of a, you know, bench bat, AAA guy, something like that. Because obviously to be a first baseman, you have to really hit. And even if you do really hit and turn into Matt Adams, apparently you also turn into a bench bat. Because there's only 30 starting spots. But I think he's another guy, a senior sign in the eighth round. You would assume, oh, he's just, you know, didn't sign for much. He's just skating by on his dad's name. It's like, no, this guy actually might sneak up on you and make the big leagues. And if not, he'll definitely get to the upper levels of the minors because there's a little more there than you would expect. And in part because when he got to Texas, he was, you know, had some attention on him and didn't really perform until his senior year when he was able to kind of, break out and sort of become the player that they were hoping you'd become.
Okay, it's already past the half hour mark. So you've nearly fulfilled your obligation to the Pitch Talks Blue Jays podcast. However, I would be remiss if I did not ask about Danny Jansen. Danny Jansen is a name I've invoked on multiple occasions on this program.
I thought it was a program.
It can be a program, too. He did not appear on many top 100 lists last year. If any, he also didn't necessarily appear in like actual organizational reports for the Blue Jays. He exhibited pretty excellent control of the bat last year. Which is, I assume, a lot of that and the possibility of him playing catcher is what got him on to the FanGraphs top 100 list.
Along with your payola.
Right, I feel like I have an understanding of the bat, but I'm always interested to hear about the sort of prognosis regarding his ability as a catcher.
It's okay.
Well, that is that's a type of report. It's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got like a slightly above average arm, nothing to write home about. He's like a fringy defensive catcher, but definitely enough to put out there if you like the bat. And even though he's not a big toolsy guy, the bat is now at the level where we project him to be a 60 hitter with 45 game power, which would translate to, you know, a hair above a 100 WRC+, which as a guy that can catch, there's like five of them in the big leagues, like that's pretty rare. So even if he's a little below average and it, you know, pulls him down to be like a 2.5 win player or something like that, like that's very interesting, especially from a guy who's already performed in AAA and is only 22. So again, it's not huge bat speed. It's average raw power. He's a 30 runner. It's a fringe defender with a solid average arm. Like you can see why he wasn't on people's radars. Like even in the minors when he was performing, it wasn't big tools or especially good. He also added prescription glasses, and that may I think he changed like the style of them or or maybe he wasn't wearing the glasses and then he was, or there was something to do with his eyes that I think had something to do with his offensive performance at the upper levels that beat expectations a bit. So now his sort of rare ability to be a plus hitter with some kind of power and be some kind of catcher has turned him into a real prospect, to the level where when Eric and I were moving him sort of up the board and we're like, does he belong in the top 100? Like, do we really like him that much? We start stacking him up like, yeah, he seems like he's as good as these guys. And then we asked around, it turns out Toronto won't trade him. Like, teams have asked about him and he's like not on the table. We're like, oh, okay, so we're not nuts. Like, we're not the only people that think this. Like, obviously the Blue Jays kind of know what they have too. And they start asking some other teams and they're like, oh yeah, we've asked for him. I'm like, okay, so you guys know what we're talking about. And you just sort of like realize you're in like a room full of people, but the lights were off. And then we turn the lights on and we're like, oh, surprise, he's in the top 100.
What were you guys all doing there with the lights off?
It was one of those like surprise parties, but the guy never showed up. And then it turns out we're waiting for Danny Jansen and he never came. So then we decided to start drinking.
Always a good choice. Travis Sedgwick. No, you're not Travis Sedgwick. You're Kyler McDaniel. Always. At this point,
be mistaken for any Fangraphs writer, it would not be Travis Sedgwick. So
I want to tell you that throughout the duration of this, my child has been crying upstairs in his room. So I am a bit unnerved. However, Kyler McDaniel, a real beverage.
The wheels are flying off.
It is a real beverage to have talked with you. Okay. Your obligation is fulfilled, is my point. Thank you so much, Kyler McDaniel.
I'm not as thunk as Drinkle Peep I am.
That has been Kyler McDaniel, lead prospect analyst emeritus, Fangraphs.com. I'm Carson Cistulli, and this has been the Pitch Talks Blue Jays Podcast.